1914 on Christmas Day, on the Western Front the guns all died away, and lying in the mud on bags of sand, we heard a German sing from no man's land. He had a tenor voice so pure and true. The words were strange, but every note we knew. And soaring o'er the living, dead and damned, that German sang of peace from no man's land.
Brendan McQuail singing Cormac McConnell's song about an almost mythical event in World War One. More from Brendan later. In December 1914, World War One had been raging for 4 months on the Western Front. The fighting had reached a stalemate, with soldiers from both sides encamped in cold and muddy trenches. On Christmas Eve, something extraordinary happened. Soldiers set aside their weapons and their hatred and came together to celebrate Christmas. Lorcan Clancy tells the story.
In the weeks leading up to Christmas, the weather had been mild and wet. In the early hours of Christmas Eve, this gave way to a hard frost. Temperatures dropped below freezing, producing a dusting of ice and snow along the Western Front. At dawn, lights began to appear. It took the British a few minutes to realise what they were. The Germans had placed hundreds of Christmas trees, decorated with candles, just outside their trenches. At first, the British thought this was some kind of trick, but then the sound of singing floated across no man's land. The Germans sang Stille Nacht. The British responded with the First Noel. Slowly and cautiously, soldiers emerged from the trenches and met in no man's land. They talked, bartered for cigarettes, and exchanged souvenirs. The atmosphere was one of holiday rather than conflict. This unofficial ceasefire was a chance for soldiers from both sides to bury their fallen comrades. In a few areas, football matches between German and British soldiers were played in the middle of no man's land. Officers on both sides disapproved of the ceasefire and took action to ensure that it couldn't be repeated. Never again would these soldiers lay down their weapons and greet their enemies as friends. Just 6 months earlier, they could never have guessed that this temporary truce would be their highlight of Christmas 1914.
The 1914 Christmas truce has become something of a legend, and when events become legends, the details can become exaggerated. I'm joined by historians Katrina Pennell of the University of Exeter and Paul Rouse from UCD, who are here to separate fact from fiction. Paul, what certainties do we know, or do we have any certainties at all? Because I have seen this disputed by so many historians so often.
I think the certainties are that there was a truce in a certain area for Christmas Day and possibly a little bit longer than that. But along the Western Front, there were very many places in which there was no truce. And certainly along the Eastern Front, there was no truce. What happened during that truce, again, is a matter of conjecture. And if you were to look at the Sainsbury's ad, for example, on British television at the moment, you would imagine that an event that took place in a certain area at a certain time happened all along the Western Front. And there is no sense of that. But there is a certain evidence that there was a singing of songs, that there was a football kicked around, although this has kind of grown into a match between England and Germany, which the Germans won 3-2.
In front of a crowd of about 50,000 in a proper stadium, etc., etc. Yeah.
It's where myth and history collide in the story of the truce.
Katrina, did they play football, for example? Was there a football match, or were there impromptu kick-arounds, or did footballs feature in no man's land at all?
I think Paul has set the scene very well, really, and this emphasis on sporadic moments of fraternisation between British and German troops along the Western Front. And Paul's absolutely right to point out that it was in certain places. Perhaps one of the most famous places was in what Tommy's referred to as Plug Street in southern Belgium. But yeah, I mean, as Paul says, there were kick-arounds. There was the presence of footballs or impromptu footballs hastily thrown together, whether that was bags stuffed with something to replicate a football. But this idea of it being a monolithic match all across the Western Front, you know, this 500-mile front line is really, really problematic and has begun something of myth and legend, particularly in British popular memory of the war.
We think of it in terms of fraternisation between British soldiers and German soldiers. Was there fraternisation, for example, between French and German soldiers, do we know?
I believe there's less evidence to suggest the incident occurred between French and German soldiers. My understanding of the event at the time is that it was something far more common between British and German troops. And I think we can understand that perhaps in terms of French soldiers fighting on home soil. You know, they were literally defending their land. So the idea of fraternization between them and their German enemy is perhaps more difficult for the, you know, the barriers of enmity to be broken down.
How long did, Katrina, how long did it all last? Are we talking about something that really happened over a few minutes? Did it happen over a few hours? What was the, you know, what were the durations involved here?
My understanding is that moments of fraternisation began on the 24th of December, which is the day that Germans traditionally celebrate Christmas, with the holding up of candles, with renditions of Christmas songs. But really, it was over, I would say, within a matter of a day or so. And certainly by January 1915, this was an event that was being reported as something of an anomaly. So it was very, very short-lived. I mean, you've got to remember, and I think it's really important to emphasise this, because the Sainsbury's advert, for many reasons, is problematic, but perhaps most problematic because it's suggesting that war is about peace and fraternisation. War is not about that. War is about killing and not being killed yourself, and it's a very bloody, horrific event that this Christmas truce perhaps turns into something more humane and cuddly.
Could these soldiers have been court-martialed?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at it from official military legal terms, this was fraternisation with the enemy, which was as bad as desertion and accusations of cowardice. You know, this was undermining the British war effort. So it happened with officers turning a blind eye or perhaps getting involved themselves, but this was not something that would have been endorsed at, you know, official central levels.
I think Katrina's absolutely right, and she's completely correct when she reminds us that war is about death. And there is something utterly cynical about the Sainsbury's ad. I mean, it is, after all, an ad, of course, and there's something cynical about most advertising, but it makes the war look beautiful. There are no rats eating dead bodies, or there is none of that portrayed inevitably in a Christmas ad, which is meant to be warm and fuzzy. I think there's something really interesting here that is not portrayed in the ad, and that is the burial of the dead bodies, which is part of the truce that people are found with, one of those things that was spoken about. It's also a simple fact that wherever that truce took place, and we know this from some of the letters, the men who were observing a truce could hear the guns booming further along the front, places where regiments were continued to fire against each other, and that shouldn't be forgotten. So I suppose the crucial question is, how has it become so much of a myth? How has it grown so much? And of course, I think it's rooted in that desire for people to find some glimmer of hope, some glimmer of normality, some glimmer of humanity amidst such appalling suffering.
OK, let's hear the middle section of Cormac McConnell's musical take on the truce. So let's hear some more from Brendan.
They left their trenches and we left ours. Beneath tin hats the smiles bloomed like wildflowers. With photos, cigarettes and tots of wine, we built a soldier's truce on the front line. Their singer was a lad of 21. We begged another song before the dawn, and sitting in the mud and blood and fear, he sang again the song all longed to hear.
Brendan McQuail there. Thank you very much indeed. We'll hear the conclusion of that song a little bit later. Let's hear this eyewitness account of the truce, a letter written in this instance by an Irish soldier at the front.
Letter dated 6th of February 1915. My dear mother and pap, now to tell you the story I put off. We went into the trenches again on Christmas Eve. It was a hard, cold and a clear night. About 7:30 p.m. the German lines were lit up by numerous lights, which turned out to be scores of candles on Christmas trees and all burning brightly. Following the appearance of the lights, the Germans began singing as loud as they could. We listened for a moment, and not a shot was fired by either side, and not even for many hours afterwards. The Germans were making happy the festival, and why not we too, thought some of the fellows in my trench. And there and then they started singing ragtime, and one or two Irish ones such as Come Back to Erin. The more we sang, the more so did the Germans. Next morning, a couple of hours after daybreak, one of the Germans shouted across four times, A Happy Christmas, English. I did not hear any of our chaps returning the compliment. I guess that's why he shouted four times.
And you can understand why there would not have been a response to Happy Christmas English. So there were Irish songs, Paul, being sung in the trenches during the Christmas truce.
Yes, there were. And there are many letters and memoirs which refer to this, including one from David Williamson from Tyrone, who talks about how on that truce arranged between the British soldiers and the Germans on Christmas Day, how the regiments to left and the right kept firing spasmodically all day, but that where he was stationed, officers and soldiers went across and they and the Germans exchanged tobacco and sauntered between the lines of trenches. And he writes in his letter, it was the queerest sight in the world to see two lots of men who a few hours previously were intent on killing each other and will be again tomorrow, but now were talking together as if they were the greatest friends. And he goes on to talk about how they even arranged a football match between them. And then he writes about how later, he's writing this letter on Christmas Day, and he says, he finishes his letter by saying, since I started writing this letter, a telephone message has come through to say that the Germans had won by 3-2. Now, this is no doubt somebody writing a letter, or most likely somebody writing a letter and just adding something for people at home.
Katrina, the reporting of all of this is very interesting because, I mean, the iconic photograph, I suppose, is the one on the front page of the Daily Mirror of the troops, some of them wearing each other's hats, all this kind of stuff, and all of them standing in a row, and this photograph is taken. But there weren't reporters at the front at this stage, and getting genuine news back was very difficult. So this is something that might have been ignored by the British press.
Yes, it wasn't reported immediately. There was, I believe, an embargo that was broken first by the New York Times on New Year's Eve 1914, and then British papers subsequently followed the breaking of that embargo with various first-hand accounts and editorials. And as you say, you refer to the famous photograph of British and German troops mingling.
Which was in January.
That was on around about the 8th of January, published in the Mirror. So there was disapproval from the British government, of course. There had to be official disapproval, and there was felt that this was a regretful thing to have been reported, these moments of fraternisation. And very, very quickly, the press got back to reporting battles and perceived to be barbaric behaviour by the German enemy that fuelled a sense of right and justice in the British and Irish cause.
Katrina, Paul has suggested that the reason why this has become mythologised and romanticised to the extent that it has is because of our need, our desire to extract crumbs of comfort from anything. Is that how you see the memorialization of the Christmas truce?
Absolutely. But there is a danger in sanitization, and that is what the commemoration of the First World War is doing, and this sense of trying to find common ground in a conflict that really was about bloody enmity between belligerent European powers.
And this is where myth runs up against history, because you cannot ignore the appalling carnage of that war, of those days, of days either side of that war. And if you look at the stories that were appearing in the newspapers right beside that story of the truce when it happened, for example, what was happening on Christmas Day on the Eastern Front, where the Russian and German armies were locked in stalemate, and you see stories of no man's land strewn with the bodies of dead soldiers and men who fought for both armies, some of them lying on the ground at impossible angles, others caught and propped against the barbed wire, bodies half buried and rotting in craters, others lying in the mucks, slowly rotting themselves. And you can wrap this up any way you want, and you can present the truce as some sort of an extraordinary moment of humanity, but all around it was brutality and carnage.
This is, you know, one day, perhaps 2 days at most, in a calendar of 4.5 years of conflict. Let's keep it in perspective. It's not to deny that moments of fraternisation happened, but the bloodshed continued the following day and continued for another 4 years. And that's really what I think we should be remembering.
Right, Katrina and Paul, thank you very much indeed for joining us, Katrina Pennell and Paul Rouse. And let's hear how the song plays out about the Christmas truce in 1914.
And in the morning all the guns boomed in the rain, and we killed them and they killed us again. At night they charged, we fought them hand to hand, and I killed the lad that sang in No Man's Land. Oh, silent night, no cannons roar. A king is born of peace forevermore. All's calm, all's bright, all brothers hand in hand. And that young soldier sings, while the song of peace still rings, though the captains and all the kings build No Man's Land. Sleep in hell.